Part 5. Paradise, Texas. There is a growing feeling that perhaps Texas is really another country, a place where the skies, the disasters, the diamonds, the politicians, the women, the fortunes, the football players, and the murders are all bigger than anywhere else. Pete Hamill. Chapter 1.
Ain't that something? Heck of a view now, ain't she?
These had been the realtor's words as they'd stood on this outcrop of rocks, looking down the valley nearly a year ago. Even then, on that December morning, it had indeed been something. Now, in the rippling heat of an early September afternoon, it was, well,
shit, Dad,
Jesus said, raising his beer to the valley.
You sure can put a thing together.
The beer was cold, metallic on his throat. He relit the joint. Man, this crop, their first, was, well, nothing on the weed in heaven, of course, but still, it was the nuts, as Morgan had put it. Pulled his hat down over his eyes and lay back on the rock, thinking. Like Dad always said, if you're in the office all the time, you're just firefighting. You needed to get out regularly, clear your head, or rather, fuzz it up a little, and let the ideas flow. This promontory where he lay looking west was where J.C. came to do just that. Collard Creek wound its way downstream away from him, all the way to the wetlands that marked the western edge of their land, nearly 3 miles away. The banks of the creek were dotted with juniper, scrub oak, live oak, mesquite, and pinyon pine. Good hunting down there in the woods towards the wetlands. White-tailed deer, scaled quail, waterfowl, the odd feral hog and wild turkey, too. Claude had shown them how you could catch the turkeys, and now they had a little pen of them over near the farm itself. Good eating, Claude had promised, proving himself right when he roasted one of those big boys whole in an oven he dug in the ground, and they ate it out under the stars with a few potatoes he'd thrown in with the bird. Over to his left, forming the southern boundary of the property, was what little Miles had imaginatively christened Big Lake, shaped like a crooked arm, over 2 miles long and about a quarter mile across at the widest point, blazing silver beneath the afternoon sun, the trophy bass and the fat catfish circling in the cooler depths. Big Bob and Morgan, keen fishermen, often heading over early in the mornings with their rods, reels, and bait. Big Lake was big enough to water ski on, too, though J.C. had yet to try it. But you'd hear Becky with Pete or Chris some afternoons, one of the guys driving the little speedboat while she shrieked with laughter behind it, her cries and the buzz of the engine carrying far across the still air. To his right, north, lay a high ridge of pine-fringed mountains, cut through by the road that eventually took you up to Bruntsville, their nearest town, 5 miles away, or onto the interstate, where you could turn left and head all the way to Austin, a good day's drive away. Now and again, you'd see cars come a little way down that hillside and pull over. Then there'd be the glinting of sunlight off highly polished glass, the long-lensed cameras of the press, the binoculars of the occasional tourist or curious local trying to get a glimpse of the freaks at play. Nestling all along the foothills of the ridge were the houses the new people were building, all in various stages of construction, the faint sound of hammering and the knifing buzzsaws carrying up to here. A couple of these new places gave right onto the other lake, Little Lake. J.C. rolled over onto his stomach, the sun hot on his back, the flat rock warm on his forearms as he propped himself to look back east. Across the roof of the big ranch house, mostly occupied by themselves, what they'd come to jokingly call the original settlers and, next to it, the first couple of houses they'd built under Pete's guidance. Fairly rickety affairs, to be sure, but watertight and windproof, with solar panels glinting all over them, towards the farm, which lay about a half a mile away. It was all activity over there, people going back and forth, wheelbarrows, crystal arcs of water sparkling from hoses and sprinklers. Behind the farm, towering over it, the two big wind turbines gently turning even in this light breeze. Claude was nervous coming into this, but man, the kid had done a job of work here. Back at the beginning of the year, in the late winter and early spring, Claude working 15-hour days, planning, planting, getting everyone to help with the digging and composting. The soil wasn't bad for the region, Claude had said, but he'd still insisted they truck in tens of thousands of dollars worth of high-grade compost. And now, here was the result of all that work, bursting up out of the ground in bold blocks of color, green rows of sugar snap and lima, southern peas and Swiss chard, yellow splashes from the fat squashes, the flowers of the zucchini plants and the succulent peppers, the red of the tomatoes and chilies. Their first harvest. He sat back up, draining that beer, the gold can crumpling up pleasingly in his hand, and burped happily, sitting here just about slap-bang in the middle of it all. 2,500 acres, almost 4 square miles of Texas hill country, just off the Edwards Prairie savanna. All theirs, bought and paid for. Jack Barry at Barry and Franklin cutting them what he called a sweet, sweet deal. $600 an acre, with the crumbling old 5-bedroom timber frame ranch house thrown in. Fish in the lakes, animals in the woods, and about every vegetable you could think of coming up through the dirt over there. Fuck, man. It was a sweet deal. His reverie is interrupted by the high-pitched growl of an engine. Jesus sits up and sees Chris coming up the dusty hillside towards him on the green dirt bike, the one on which Chris had painted "Eat My Balls" across the petrol tank. He ramps up over the edge of the hill, kills the engine, and lays the bike down on its side, walking the last few yards so as not to shower JC in dust. "Hey, man," Chris says, easing himself down onto the rock next to Jesus. Man, fat Chris was nearly no more. He must have lost 30 pounds over the summer. Miles away from junk food, working in the dirt with Claude or in among all the timber with Pete, eating right and swimming every morning. "Hey, big fella," JC says, passing him the J. "How's tricks?" "Got some new arrivals down there." Chris nods north towards where the private road down the mountain terminates at the gates onto the estate itself. "Oh, yeah? Where from?"
Family from Detroit, I think."
"Few more from the Motor City, huh?"
"They've had several arrivals from Detroit. Place was on its knees." Goddamn shame, Jesus thought. It was a good rock and roll town. MC5, Stooges, White Stripes. Bunch of righteous techno stuff, too.
"Yeah, well, Becky's dealing with it, but you'd better come down. They want to talk to you. Mr. Detroit's got handguns and stuff."
Aw, man, not again.
It had happened a bunch of times already. People wanting to come out here and live in total peace and harmony with a fucking magnum under their pillow. Some Americans, man, naked without that peace.
"Hey, JC."
"Big guy."
"Hey, you want to play some touch football later?"
He smiles and waves and returns the odd high five as he follows Chris across the dusty courtyard. Kids running around. Saturday morning. Man, every day felt like Saturday morning, and every night felt like Friday night. Jesus hears a snare drum fill clattering across on the breeze. Morgan, down there in the studio they're building, tinkering with the kit, not happy with the drum sound he's been getting. They hadn't gone too nuts buying guitars and stuff. Chris got a new Fender Precision bass, and JC treated himself to a gorgeous off-white 1960 Les Paul Jr., double cutaway, a la Johnny Thunders. They'd been working hard at demoing tracks for JC's album, not without pressure and disagreement. For the past 6 months, Stelfox and JC had been locked in argument over what the two contractual cover versions should be. Stelfox had flown in by chopper to hear work in progress back in July and had basically told them to make the vocals louder, cut all the guitar solos, and get to all the choruses faster. Then he'd choppered straight back out with a remark about why was JC living in a hippie cesspit when he had millions of dollars in the bank. "Hey, Bex," Jesus says, taking in the scene as he arrives at the main gate. Becky, her back to him, arms folded, a bad sign, looking good in cut-off denim pants and an olive-green combat vest, talking to a little white guy with glasses and a Tigers baseball cap. Mr. Detroit, JC guesses. His family, an even tinier wife and two kids, boy and a girl, around 10 or 11, are clustered behind him, and the little girl squeaks with delight when Jesus appears.
"He looks different from on TV,"
she whispers to her brother. The whole family seem to straighten up when Jesus appears, smiling at him. Fame. Fame, fatal fame, Jesus thinks. It can play hideous tricks on the brain. "Hi, folks. What's the problem?" "The problem," Becky says, "is that Terrence here has a gun in his luggage."
"Just give it to them," the wife hisses.
"Sorry, buddy, no weapons," Jesus says.
"But I just saw a guy walking by over there with a rifle."
"Yeah, we got rifles here for hunting," Jesus goes on, "which you're welcome to use as and when you want to go hunting, but we don't allow personal firearms."
But it was expensive. What'll happen to it?"
"I already told you," Becky begins, near boiling point now.
"It's cool, Bex," JC says, planting a hand softly on her shoulder. "I got this one.
We'll keep it safely stored, and if you ever want to leave, you can have it back."
"We should just dump the lot of them in the goddamn lake," Becky says.
"Do I get a receipt?" the guy, Terrence, asks.
That's not really how we do things around here," Jesus laughs.
"Terrence," the wife hisses.
Okay,
He goes into his rucksack and digs out an ugly-looking black revolver. "I didn't mean to cause trouble. I didn't know what to expect here, you know?" Chris takes the gun as Jesus ushers them through the gate. "You haven't caused any trouble, Terrence. Come on in." "Hi, kids, ma'am. I'm Jesus. Most people call me JC.
"Oh, we know who you are,"
the wife laughs, girlishly, thrilled.
"I'm Teresa Brokaw. This is Sean and Claire."
"You sure put that Stelfox guy in his place,"
little Claire says.
"Ah, he's not so bad."
Jesus is capable of lying. The family Brokaw follows JC and Bex into the compound, taking it all in, their necks craning around, the air tangy with the smell of grilling meat, music drifting from somewhere. Hard funk, George Clinton or something, and the sound of hammering and sawing. "If you're hungry," JC is saying, pointing over to the 10-foot-long grill, "we got some barbecue burning right over there. Sleeping-wise, you'll find cots in those Quonset huts down along that path there by the woods," Jesus points off down a wooden walkway. "That's where we put new folks at first. There's showers and toilets and whatnot down there, too. Or you're welcome to pitch a tent about anywhere you like. And, well, that's about it for now, guys. We can go over the other stuff later. You want a soda or something? Beers?"
They've arrived at the shaded porch off the main house. Bob is playing racing cars with Miles on the deck.
"Yeah, thanks," Terrence Brokaw says. I guess I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I'd read about it, but it's kind of like being at a rock festival, huh?"
"Yeah, maybe," Jesus says, digging in a cooler, coming up with some icy beers and a couple of sodas for the kids. but without the $200 tickets, $15 burgers, and lame corporate rock.
Cheers.
They touch cans and sit down on the wooden steps.
A regular utopia, huh?
Teresa says, taking her sunglasses off. Jesus groans. Please, don't call it that. It's not a utopia.
What would you call it?
Just a community, maybe, in the sense of what that used to mean. They nod, sipping their beers, looking uphill towards the farm.
How many people live here?
The little girl asks. Maybe a couple of hundred now, Claire. Families, individuals, what have you.
Wow, they're big. Those wind turbines, huh?
Terrence says, gesturing with his beer.
Yeah.
Jesus follows his admiring gaze towards the pair of glinting propellers. We got a fella in from the Horse Hollow Wind Energy Center, over in Taylor and Nolan County. I say we. Old Pete over here was the one who took care of it. Hey, Pete, Jesus calls to Pete, who is standing over some blueprints spread out on a bench in the sun. These are the Brokaws from Detroit.
Hey there,
Pete says, coming over, offering his hand. Anyway, Jesus goes on, Pete got this fella in, and he laid out how we could do it all, even source those bad boys secondhand for us. Cleaned us out of the best part of $500,000 for the pair. But they generate what, Pete?
Nearly 1,000,000 kilowatts per annum.
What with the solar panels for the hot water and all? We're just about totally energy sufficient, baby.
Yeah, when they work, Bex says.
Yeah, they were a pain in the ass at first, Pete says. Not storing up energy properly, not turning over when they should have been. In the end, the guy put a couple of little digital video cameras up there on top of them to monitor the props 24/7, find out when they were turning over. They record right onto hard drives in the base of the turbines.
Sure, we've had some teething problems, Jesus allows. Old Bex here is kind of a glass half empty kind of chick.
Get bent. Someone's got to be practical around here, Bex says. So when, Terrence says, wiping beer foam from his top lip, when do you have services and stuff?
Services?
JC says.
Yeah, like church and prayer and whatnot.
Jesus and Becky both laugh. Dude, Becky says, you have most definitely come to the wrong place for that.